Happy New Year! Welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes we'll be featuring articles from Religion News Service, from the Washington Post, from CBS News, and more. Today's broadcast is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The contents of this program are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin the first edition of Religion in the News for 2020 with an article that actually stretches back to 2019. This is from Religion News Service dated December 19th. And the headline on this article, Christianity Today editor argues morally compromised Trump should be removed from office. This article is dated December 19th by Jack Jenkins of Religion News Service. Mark Galley, the editor-in-chief of the influential evangelical magazine Christianity Today, says that President Donald Trump should be removed from office. In an editorial on Trump's impeachment published Thursday, December 19th, Galley argued that even though Democrats have had it out for Trump since his election, the case for the president's impeachment, which the House of Representatives voted to approve on Wednesday, was convincing. Trump, he said, was morally unable to lead. The facts in this instance are unambiguous. The President of the United States attempted to use his political power to coerce a foreign leader to harass and discredit one of the President's political opponents, he wrote. That is not only a violation of the Constitution, more importantly, it is profoundly immoral. He noted that Christianity Today also spoke out when Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton were facing impeachment, and Galley made it clear that he believes Trump lacks the morality to lead the country. The reason many are not shocked about this is that this president has dumbed down the idea of morality in his administration. He has hired and fired a number of people who are now convicted criminals, he wrote. He himself has admitted to immoral actions in business and his relationship with women, about which he remains proud. His Twitter feed alone, with its habitual string of mischaracterizations, lies, and slanders, is a near-perfect example of a human being who is morally lost and confused. In an interview with Religion News Service on Thursday, Galley explained that he decided to publish the piece in part because of the magazine's history of speaking out during previous impeachment cases and in part because of Trump's actions. It's just an unambiguous moment in which it is absolutely clear that there's just no question what Trump was trying to do, he said. I've been rolling this around in my mind for a week or two, he said. This morning I just walked into the office and asked a colleague, should we write an editorial about this? And we said, yeah, I had the editorial written in about an hour. Galley, who will retire in January, said the topic of Trump's behavior was one he has thought about for months, if not years. It wasn't like I had to do a bunch of research to find out what he does on Twitter, he said. In his editorial, Galley said that Trump's removal may have to wait till the 2020 election. But either by impeachment or election, Galley said, Trump should leave office. Whether Mr. Trump should be removed from office by the Senate or by popular vote next election, that is a matter of prudential judgment. That he should be removed, we believe, is not a matter of partisan loyalties, but loyalty to the creator of the Ten Commandments, he wrote. Galley said he doesn't expect his editorial to change many minds and doesn't believe many hardline evangelical Trump supporters subscribe to his magazine. He added that he doesn't belong to either major political party and voted third party in the last election. People are going to think of it as if it's partisan, he said. I'm not joining the Democratic Party to take Trump down. White evangelical Christians in particular still support Trump in large numbers. But asked if his editorial speaks to a minority of evangelicals who are unsettled by Trump's presidency but unwilling to speak out, Galley said yes. He said he understands why they haven't been more vocal, however. I understand why they've been more quiet, because there are people I love and have relationships with who are deeply committed to supporting Donald Trump because of his views on abortion and religious freedom, he said. So naturally they're hesitant to speak out too loudly or with too much condemnation, which will offend, hurt, and maybe alienate people that are lifelong friends, people they dearly love. Even so, he felt comfortable with his decision. It's just the right thing to say at this moment, and this is the right thing to do. Christianity Today was founded in 1956 by famed evangelist Billy Graham. His son Franklin Graham has been a stalwart supporter of Trump and a critic of the impeachment process, saying in a November Facebook post that it makes me sick to my stomach. The younger Graham told the New York Times Christianity Today was part of a liberal element among evangelicals. My father would be embarrassed, he told the Times in response to Galley's editorial. While Franklin Graham has been reluctant to criticize Trump's actions, his father took a different tack during the Watergate controversy. Despite his friendship with Nixon, Billy Graham told Christianity Today in early 1974 that he condemned the Watergate break-in and said it had hurt America. He also said that Nixon, like anyone, would be better off if he admitted his mistakes. It's better to show humility, and it's better to say I'm wrong or I'm sorry when you've made a mistake, he said. The Bible says, thou shalt not bear false witness. That commandment has never been rescinded, and lying is wrong, no matter who does it. RNS spoke with Galley earlier this week when the magazine had yet to comment on the impeachment proceedings. It's very much a political story, and it's hard to find a uniquely Christian angle to it, which is what would be required for us to comment on it, Galley told RNS at the time. Certainly there are ethical issues at play, but there are ethical issues at play in every political story. If we commented on each one, we'd be politics today. We turn next to an article from December 17th, published in the Washington Post on religion in the news. This article is headlined, Does Your Pastor Preach Too Long? A new survey shows the dramatic difference in sermons. This is by Sarah Pulliam Bailey of the Washington Post. One of America's most famous sermons, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, probably took Jonathan Edwards close to an hour to deliver in 1741. Today, most white Protestant pastors wouldn't dare keep people in the pews that long. In a new report released Monday, the Pew Research Center analyzed nearly 50,000 sermons posted online by 6,431 churches this year to find out how long Christian clergy preach and the words they use that distinguish them from one another. Pew analyzed audio, video, and word count of sermons to estimate the length of sermons in different denominations. The average length of a sermon, researchers found, is 37 minutes, but there are striking differences across traditions. 14 minutes for Catholics, 25 minutes for mainline Protestants, 39 minutes for evangelicals, and 54 minutes for historically black Protestants. Several pastors face pressure to keep trimming the length of sermons to fit people's minimal attention spans, said the Reverend Tim Keller, the longtime evangelical pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. I don't think most evangelical pastors are good enough for a 39-minute sermon, Keller said. That needs to shorten. Keller said when he started preaching 40 years ago, regular church attendance meant someone was in the pew 3 out of 4 Sundays. That number has dropped. Now a regular churchgoer appears maybe 1.75 out of 4 Sundays. He wonders whether that's because many are listening to sermons via podcast or online streaming as a fallback for showing up for a service. If I preach a good sermon, if you're in the midst of other people, you're going to remember it more and be shaped by it than if you pick it up in a podcast somewhere, he said. If it's totally supplemental, then it's fine. If, on the other hand, if it undermines the times you're in a Christian community, it's disastrous. In a sermon heard around the world last year, the Reverend Michael Curry, who is the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, delivered a message at the royal wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle in about 13 minutes. In that message, he said, he focused on love because it was a universal theme. I was very aware in the sermon I was preaching that I couldn't default to Christian vocabulary, he said. He said he learned to preach to a broad range of people when he was a minister in southern Ohio, preaching to someone who did domestic work and another person with a PhD. Curry said he prepares his sermons throughout the week by tapping notes on his iPhone, usually telling a story with one takeaway instead of several. A pitfall is to explain a story too much, Curry said. If you start explaining a story, you're messing it up. Your job is to paint the picture and tell the story. Historically black Protestant churches have been at the center of many black Americans' lives, but more black pastors are trimming their services to adapt to people's attention spans, said Susan Johnson Cook, who has served as a pastor for the past 30 years. One day a week for 1 hour a week, we deposit not just scripture, but history and the application, said Cook, who was the ambassador for international religious freedom under President Barack Obama. You have a lot to cover, including social issues. The homily is a much disputed topic in Catholic parishes, and African-American parishes often include longer homilies. Many priests believe that the homily, which often includes insight, theological reflection, and practical challenges, shouldn't distract from the Eucharist. The Reverend John Baldwin, a Jesuit priest who is a professor of liturgy and the sacraments at Boston College, estimates that the average Catholic priest spends 2 hours preparing for a sermon, devoting the rest of the week to managing the parish or other ministry needs, such as visiting people in the hospital. "I won't preach more than 10 minutes on a Sunday," said Baldwin, who splits his time at parishes near Boston. "You can tell when people are ready for you to land a plane. There's nothing worse than listening to a plane come into the runway and take off again." Pew's survey also found that certain words and phrases are used more frequently in the sermons of some Christian groups. Evangelical sermons mention eternal hell and phrases about trespassing and sin and salvation more often than other Christian sermons. Just under 1 in 10 individual evangelical sermons mentions these terms. Catholic homilies tend to use Eucharist and chalice more, pointing to the focus in Catholic churches on receiving the Eucharist. Churchgoers at historically black Protestant churches were 8 times as likely than others to hear a phrase including the word hallelujah. The language that most distinguishes sermons in mainline Protestant churches include disciple, betray, and bent look, phrases tied to biblical stories. Edwards' famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, provided imagery that God holds a spider over the fiery pit of hell to describe the wrath of God. Edwards taught that you understand through your senses, not through your reasoning, Keller said, and that the purpose of the sermon is not just to make an idea clear, but to make it real. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God is odd. It's severe and not how he preached all the time. It's a model of his method, Keller said. The difference between clear and real is preaching that connects the truth to sensory experiences. The churches in the survey are not representative of all houses of worship or even all Christian churches in the United States. They make up a small percentage of the estimated 350,000-plus religious congregations nationwide, Pew notes. The churches that post sermons online tend to be in urban areas and have larger-than-average congregations, according to Pew's report. Next up on Religion in the News, we'll turn to a story from CBS This Morning, published on December 18th. This has a video with it, and for most of what this is will be a transcript of that video, although not entirely. The headline, "Baha'i Faith Teaches the Oneness of All World Religions." This is there's a note at the top of the story that says, "In our series World of Worship, we're exploring different ways people practice faith and religion around the globe. In this installment, we go on a journey to the Mother Temple of the West to look at one of the fastest-growing new religions in the world." Just outside Chicago, on the shores of Lake Michigan, sits the oldest surviving Baha'i House of Worship. Every Baha'i temple has 9 sides, 9 doors, 9 gardens and fountains, says Joyce Litoff of the U.S. Baha'i National Center, told CBS This Morning Saturday co-host Dana Jacobson. 9 is a symbol of completeness and unity. Litoff was attracted to the Baha'i faith because, she said, it teaches what she already believes. "My mother was Jewish and my father was Catholic, and then I married a Jewish man, so I've actually lived in 2 religious communities. And when I learned about the Baha'i faith that embraces the teachings of other religions, it made total sense to me," Litoff said. Founded in 1844 in Iran, the religion teaches the oneness of all world religions. The idea of oneness is carved into the temple's exterior, which includes the Jewish Star of David, the Christian cross, and the Star and Crescent of Islam. But Litoff said there's a misconception that the Baha'i faith is a mishmash, that we believe everything. "We believe in this progressive revelation that the teachings of these great spiritual teachers, they all have their time and place. And so we embrace the religions that came before," she said. Baha'is believe theirs is the religion of the future. Inside each temple, there's 1 dome representing 1 God. At least twice a day, there are prayer services with readings from various world religions, but there are no sermons or clergy. That lack of ritual is partly what drew 28-year-old Matthew Cotton to the faith. He was raised Catholic on the south side of Chicago. Cotton said his mother was very supportive of him. "At first, she wanted to ask some clarifying questions, that if this was a cult," Cotton said. I told her, to the best of my knowledge, it didn't seem like a cult to me, that this really seemed like a global world religion of people engaging with their fellow citizens, who weren't Baha'is, in order to be of service to humanity. He added, to me, building unity looks like creating opportunities for everyone to see themselves as part of one family, no matter their race, gender, or economic status. Seeing each other first as souls. Music director Van Gilmer has been working toward racial justice since the Civil Rights era. In 1963, he participated in sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina. The idea of one humanity is very attracting. We talked about it in my church, but my church is African American. That church in Greensboro, North Carolina is still African American, Gilmer said. All the churches in Greensboro are either one race or another race. We say and we believe one thing, but when it comes to what we're doing about it, if we're not showing it, if we're not working at it, then those were the things that influenced me to become a Baha'i. Because there's no hierarchy in the religion, Baha'is around the world elect at least 9 people to represent them in their local spiritual assemblies. There are no ministers, so the burden is back on the individual to not only read the writings that the best thing in my sight is justice, to be just, not to just read or have somebody talk about it to me, but try to figure out how I'm going to be just in the things that I do, Gilmer said. It's a community working toward justice by focusing on practicing instead of preaching. There are somewhere between 5 and 6 million Baha'is worldwide and about 177,000 in the United States. There are 8 continental Baha'i temples, making it the second most geographically diverse region in the world, behind Christianity. We'll turn next back to Religion News Service, and this is an article dated December 19th by Jack Jenkins. The headline, "Despite Whistleblower Complaint, Experts Say IRS Backlash to Mormon Group Unlikely." The Mormon world was rocked on Monday, December 16th, when news broke that a whistleblower had accused the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints of misleading members regarding more than $100 billion retained in accounts accumulated from tithe donations. But despite ample hand-wringing, legal experts are skeptical the news will trigger a backlash from the IRS, and they note that the LDS Church's tradition of aggressive saving dates back decades. According to the Washington Post, the whistleblower, David A. Nielsen, called on the IRS to strip the tax-exempt status from Ensign Peak Advisors, an organization affiliated with the church that houses its money and puts it into an investment portfolio to generate additional funds. Nielsen alleged that the organization has not used the money to give to charity, but has instead largely retained it, except for bailing out businesses and other ventures. Church leaders released a rare statement in response that did not directly confirm the whistleblower's account, but acknowledged the existence of funds set aside as a prudent reserve for the future, and said the church is abiding by its beliefs. This is a sound doctrinal and financial principle taught by the Savior in the parable of the talents, and lived by the church and its members, the statement reads in part. All church funds exist for no other reason than to support the church's divinely appointed mission. According to the Washington Post, the whistleblower alleged the church leaders offered a more specific justification. They were set aside in the event of the second coming, the belief in a time when Jesus Christ will return to earth, as foretold in the book of Revelation. But theological justifications are unlikely to matter, said Sam Brunson, author of God and the IRS, Accommodating Religious Practice in United States Tax Law. From a tax perspective, if Ensign Peak Advisors makes that assertion, it doesn't have any tax relevance, he said. Instead, Brunson explained that one of the core issues embedded in the complaint is that the church uses a separate entity, Ensign Peak Advisors, to hold its funds. Storing money is not atypical for a religious entity like the LDS Church. Many charities hold on to money themselves or make use of traditional outside investment funds. Harvard University is known for a $41 billion endowment, for instance, and has been referred to by the nation as a hedge fund with the university attached. According to Nathan Oman, a professor at William & Mary Law School and an expert in LDS Church legal history, the church's habit of aggressive saving emerged from a series of financial near calamities. At various points in its history, the Mormon Church has had financial difficulties and were not able to meet expenses out of revenues, he said. Forecasting costs and controlling costs were things that church leaders weren't really good at doing yet. Brunson noted that the mid-20th century is also when the church became more circumspect about revealing details of its finances. Oman explained that it was around the same time in the late 1960s that Nathan Eldon Tanner, a former legislator in Alberta, Canada, was called upon to help the church remain financially solvent. Tanner put in place three basic principles of financial management for the church, said Oman, who is Mormon. The first principle is they never spend more money in a given year than they take in tithing revenue. The second principle is you never borrow money. And the third principle is you take part of your tithing donations every year and you put them in a rainy day fund for the future. But according to the whistleblower complaint, the way the LDS Church is currently storing money is unusual. Ensign Peak Advisors is designated as a supporting organization and integrated auxiliary of the LDS Church and is granted tax-exempt status. In a blog post for the Mormon website, By Common Consent, Brunson explained that Ensign Peak Advisors falls under a murky category for the IRS. The agency has granted tax exemptions in the past to money-holding organizations whose sole purpose is charitable, but only if the funds they eventually dole out are commensurate in scope with its financial resources. The IRS has never said what commensurate in scope means, Brunson said, noting that some interpretations would argue that Ensign Peak Advisors had run afoul of tax law. Philip Hackney, a law professor at the University of Pittsburgh and a former IRS official, said the report may evoke debate over whether religious groups should be allowed to retain massive endowments without disclosing them. I think the endowment is a live question for society in terms of what an endowment in a charitable solution is for, he said. However, even if the IRS came down on the group, Brunson downplayed the potential repercussions of the complaint. He said Ensign Peak Advisors likely accrued most of its money in time periods that fall beyond the statute of limitations for such cases, limiting the impact were it to be stripped of its tax-exempt status. Even if there is something there, there's not a lot of revenue for potentially a lot of work, he said. This probably isn't going to be something that will be on their plate. Brunson expressed doubts the IRS will take any action at all. Frankly, the IRS has been underfunded and understaffed for 15 years at least, Brunson said. Hackney agreed, although he noted that that could change if IRS officials found evidence of impropriety in transactions not detailed in the whistleblower report. If they were to find something problematic with spending out money for for-profit entities, that could be a different issue, he said. I think that's another can of worms. In the meantime, Brunson suggested increased transparency regarding church finances. He pointed to the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability, an evangelical Christian organization that outlines guidelines for churches regarding financial accountability, transparency, fundraising, and board governance. I don't think it would be a bad idea for the Mormon Church, and frankly other churches, to follow that, he said. We'll wrap up this week's edition of Religion in the News with an article from the Associated Press dated December 20th. The headline on this is written in the past tense, but it's still something present. Notre Dame Cathedral to miss first Christmas in centuries. This is by Thomas Adamson of the Associated Press, Dateline Paris, and it's slightly edited for time. Notre Dame kept Christmas going even during two world wars, a beacon of hope amid the bloodshed. Yet an accidental fire in peacetime finally stopped the Paris Cathedral from celebrating midnight mass this year for the first time in over two centuries. As the lights stay dim in the once invincible 855-year-old landmark, officials are trying hard to focus on the immediate task of keeping burned-out Notre Dame's spirit alive in exile through service, song, and prayer. It has decamped its rector, famed statue, liturgy, and Christmas celebrations to a new temporary home pending the restoration works, just under a mile away, at another Gothic church in Paris called Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois. And there it will remain, as work slowly progresses to rebuild the cathedral after the April 15th fire destroyed its lead roof and spire and was moments away from engulfing its two stone towers. This is the first time since the French Revolution that there will be no midnight mass at Notre Dame, Cathedral Rector Patrick Chauvet told the Associated Press. There was even a Christmas service amid the carnage of World War I, Chauvet noted, because the canons were there and the canons had to celebrate somewhere, referring to the cathedral's clergy. During World War II, when Paris was under Nazi occupation, there was no problem. He said that to his knowledge, it was only closed for Christmas in the period after 1789, when the anti-Catholic French revolutionaries turned the monument into a temple of reason. Christmas in exile at Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois this year will be a history-making moment. We have the opportunity to celebrate Mass outside the walls, so to speak, but with some indicators that Notre Dame is connected to us, Chauvet said. Those indicators include a wooden liturgical platform that has been constructed in the Saint-Germain Church to resemble Notre Dame's own. A service will be led at midnight on December 24th by Chauvet to a crowd of faithful, including many who would normally worship in the cathedral, accompanied by song from some of Notre Dame's now itinerant choir. The cathedral's iconic Gothic sculpture, the Virgin of Paris, from which some say Notre Dame owes its name, is also on display in the new annex. The 14th century masterpiece, which measures around 2 meters or 6 feet and depicts Mary and the baby Jesus, has come to embody the official's message of hope following the fire. It's a miraculous virgin. Why? Because at the time of the fire, the vault of the cathedral completely crashed. There were stones everywhere, but she was spared. She could have naturally received the vault on her head and have been completely crushed, Chauvet said. He recalled the moment on the night of the fire when he discovered it was saved, as he was holding hands with French President Emmanuel Macron on the cathedral's forecourt. Around midnight, as the flames subsided, they were finally led inside to look. Chauvet pointed and exclaimed to Macron, "Look at the Virgin. She is there." He said later that Notre Dame's workmen on the ground implored him to not remove the statue from the cathedral, saying that during the restoration, "We need it. She protects us." Chauvet said having it nearby for Christmas is comforting. She lived very much in Notre Dame. She watched the pilgrims, all the 35,000 visitors a day. "It keeps us going," Chauvet said. Another reason for hope. Since November, after months in the dark, the facade of the cathedral is being lit up after dusk for the first time since the fire. Tourists over the festive period can now see the famed gargoyles and stone statues at night in their full illuminated splendor from the adjacent bridges, although the forecourt is still closed. Though Notre Dame has moved liturgically to a new home, Notre Dame will always remain Paris's cathedral, so long as the bishop's physical chair, or cathedra, doesn't move. Notre Dame was home to a vibrant 160-strong choir school, which provided singers for each of the cathedral's 1,000 annual services. Midnight Mass at Christmas was always a special event in the year, one of the rare times the entire choir sung together and used the cathedral's famed acoustics to their fullest. In the grand scheme of things, 5 or 6 years of restoration for an 855-year-old cathedral is nothing at all, Chauvet reasoned. Macron declared in the days after the blaze it would take a mere 5 years to restore the cathedral, a timeline many experts deem unrealistic. Despite having to walk around a lot now, people have gotten used to the choir's new lifestyle, and it was just a matter of time before there will be song in the cathedral once again. In the meantime, the important thing for us is that we keep on singing and doing the music. That's what brings us together. We've reached the end of our time for this week's edition of Religion in the News. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's broadcast was generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget, we're available as a podcast on our website. Visit ncreadingservice.org. And we'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.